Good afternoon. Scott Spears back with you here Thursday, April the 20th, 2017. 1:14 coming up on 1:15 Eastern Daylight Time. Having a very interesting discussion with the author of Blood, Money, and Power, How LBJ Killed JFK, Barr McClellan. Barr, great to have you back for hour number two here, and take me back to November 22nd, 1963. How did this date, why was this date picked, and take me through what happened?
On November 22nd?
Yes.
The crime itself was very short-lived. I mean, it was one of those things, you know, 6 seconds and gone, which could happen only with careful planning that covers up are already in place. But John Kennedy made the decision to go to Dallas because he was getting ready for the next election. It was coming up in less than a year. And he was having trouble with Johnson and was getting ready to fire him. There's all kinds of material out showing that he was working with the news, as the president can do, working with the news to go after him. So they get into town, and he is greeted, first of all, with a really mean attack from H.L. Hunt, one of the major oil company, one of the major oil owners, who worked with some of the major oil companies were there. He comes into town, Kennedy comes into town, has a magnificent parade. Everyone loved him. He goes through the heart of Dallas, gets to the school book depository. They make a sharp turn, and waiting up on the sixth floor are snipers. Now, we've got more information on that. There may have been two others. But the big question has been always, was there one over on a grassy knoll, which was in front? And the convoy, the car limo, goes slowly down the street, and in the course of 6 seconds, starting, as you mentioned earlier, almost exactly at 12:30, shots ring out. Three or four, no one knows for sure. The evidence is really hard to pin down. One of them allegedly hits Kennedy from behind. I mentioned earlier that Gerald Ford changed the evidence to show it was higher up than it was on the pictures. Another shot rings out, and Kennedy is hit, Connelly is hit this time, knocked, well, really out of commission. He was really badly wounded. For about 2 seconds, the limo moves down Elm Street, and another shot rings out. Some say two. This one seems to come from the front because Kennedy's head snaps back, and it's a fatal shot. I mean, it's right forehead. He dies. He's dead. The limo speeds off to Parkland Hospital, where they make futile efforts and can do nothing. Arrests are made. A film is produced. A Warren Commission is named after Johnson wants to name a Texas commission of his friends. And it reviews all the evidence, concludes that Lee Harvey Oswald, who was arrested right after, well, that's not quite right. He manages to get away from the whole scene and is arrested at a theater a few miles away. The Warren Commission concludes that Oswald acted alone, although it later is shown that a lot of the evidence that was gathered was either altered or changed in some way or another. 2 days after he's arrested, as we've been talking about, Jack Ruby suddenly shows up and administers a fatal shot to Oswald. It takes a gangster-type gangland shot to do the job, but he shoots him across the front chest, and it's fatal. The Warren Commission concludes Oswald acted alone. Case closed.
Who?
2 years later, a Zapruder film, a fellow who was recording the passage of the limo down Elm Street, shows what happens. And this is where I think most people end up if they weren't questioning the gangland shooting and the so-called accuracy of the Oswald shots, who was not an accurate shooter. This is when you can really look at the movement and see that John Kennedy's head, when he supposedly is shot from behind, his head moves backwards, indicating a shot from the front. They'd already made a, they, the Warren Commission, had already made an adjustment of the bullet from behind. The one I'd said earlier was one that hit Kennedy from behind, and then another that hit John Connally, who was riding right in front of Kennedy. The Warren Commission said that was one bullet, and somehow it zigzagged and hit both John Kennedy and John Connally. And that's the one where Gerald Ford gets in there and moves pictures and bullets around to make it look like one bullet could do it. Never been able to do it again. When Gordon, who I mentioned earlier, is doing a book on it, who was the sniper with the Marine Corps, what I call a Marine extraordinary. You know, you don't know how much the Marines do for us, but they really do protect us. But he can say that, you know, that just can't happen. Everyone I know is a Marine, tells me the same thing. Anyway, this incredulous evidence is presented by the Warren Commission, and small wonder, America, maybe it's a good thing we're like Missouri, what is it? Ask questions, prove it. We don't believe them. And I really, 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 as I've been saying, lay that on our integrity as a country. I mean, we've got to be shown. Maybe that's the answer to your earlier question about why Harding's wife, you know, they didn't look further. They didn't come up with anything.
It,
show me is what we have to do here.
It's very... go ahead.
No one's been able to show what really happened, and the historians don't even touch it. The politicians, well, you know, they kind of, you know how politicians are, they'll say anything. And it ends up, we've got this 70% of America saying you're wrong. You've got the Kennedy family badly treated. You've got John Jr., and I have a poem he wrote where he calls for penitence, because when he wrote the poem in 1977, the Kennedy family had not gotten justice. And we really, really, really need to evaluate all of this vast evidence we have, this totality of the evidence, to see what really happened. And anyone who takes a look at everything that's come out, you've got to conclude. It goes right to beyond a reasonable doubt, as I say in the History Channel tape, beyond a reasonable doubt, John Kennedy was assassinated and Lyndon Johnson was behind it.
Did anybody know in the administration, J. Edgar Hoover, Bobby Kennedy, any of the Kennedy aides, who were also, some were friends of Johnson, did anybody know this was happening?
Bobby Kennedy's immediate reaction was that somebody was behind it. And he made a few phone calls just to ask directly, you know, were you behind it? Everybody denied it. I think there was a suspicion, and I get this because, as I say, when I put my book out, a lot of people got hold of me. They didn't realize they had answers to the questions. I mean, they had, that they had the answers, and I was presenting the questions. And the military was almost unanimous when they called me that they were behind it in Washington, the swamp. I'm not sure I got all your question, but I think the point is that there was a great deal of suspicion because of what America was seeing. You got a gangland killing. You got evidence that this doesn't stack up with what we're being told. There was a conspiracy.
Well,
and it's time to do something about it. And a few things in my books that are being proposed are that we honor the people who did really honorable things. We give a couple of pardons that are owed. And we correct government. The one I love is, I don't know if you know, but the government can lie to us whenever they want to. Well, we need to make that illegal, make it criminal. And there's a proposal in my book for a JFK ethics that would rewrite the government code to do just that. We've got to do something about this. I'm thinking, with O'Reilly coming on next, why don't you arrange it so he and I can have a little discussion someday?
One of my questions is, in this whole thing, part of this conspiracy, two of the names that most people will know are Lee Harvey Oswald and
Hello?
Jeff... Yeah, are you still there? Are you still there?
Scott, I'm having trouble hearing you.
Yeah,
I'm not sure what the reason is.
Is that any better?
Maybe I've been talking too long.
No. Here,
go ahead.
Yeah, who are Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby in this?
Lee Harvey Oswald is what he said he was. Fall guy. Ruby was sent in by the mob. I had a call from them. Strange things come up, I'm telling you. But I got a call from one of them, and he said, well, Ruby, we probably did him. So I had a friend in the mob who I called, and he called his friends in New Orleans and said, yeah, they were going to tell you that to make sure you had it right. Well, I don't know what you do to the weight you can place on things like that, but this is what's happened to me in talking to all these people. So many people have come forward with everything, and it's made me ever more comfortable with what I wrote and have out there. And I'm going to have to get you the next book.
Yeah, it's tremendously fascinating. And when we look at this whole thing, if you had to... there are people who like LBJ. They like some of the things he did. Why was he evil? Born that way? Just had a bone to pick? People love that he signed the Civil Rights Act. They love that he signed the Voting Rights Act. They love that he did Head Start. A lot of great legislation.
And you can lay it all and thank John Kennedy for starting the ball, and he would have finished it. But let me add one thing. There was a record we had at the law firm, a penthouse records, I called them, of everything we'd done for the Johnson family, sealed away. And in it, it was well known that we had arranged psychiatric treatment for Johnson. But trying to find out who it was difficult. But I've gotten enough information to know that a small firm on... in Austin had been behind it, and Johnson was parasuicidal. Now, this becomes very dangerous in the hands of a man who has his hands on the nuclear weapons, because Johnson was also a Christadelphian, and the Christadelphians' belief was the world was going to end. And the millennialists, as we call them, are in a position, and Johnson was in a position to end the world. So we come up with a question of needing to keep a close eye on the president, and maybe close attention to his medical condition, because this thing was not revealed. But he was killing himself. It was so bad that they dedicated the library to him. In fact, that was the last time I saw him. He and Clark, you talk about coincidental, I don't know about that, but they had a big fountain there at the LBJ Library, and I was walking out, and he was there, and I walked over and talked to him for just a few minutes. He was a goner then. The guy had lost everything. He had an ambition that would not end. I think there's something that needs to be explored, and, you know, you've heard ambition is just total corruption, becomes total corruption, of how that can drive you to a parasuicidal sense. But we need to be able to see what these mindsets are doing and keep a close eye on them. In his case, it would have sure been justified.
What kind of guy was LBJ if you would have met him?
Well, I had enough rang into him and through Clark to know that he was a hale and fairly well guy, but he was mean. I mean, he insisted on getting what he wanted. You could run into it, and there was no excuse for not getting a job done. If he asked you to do something, you better do it right away, and you better do it right, and it better be his way. Of course, he abused women, something awful. That was just part of, I don't know how to explain that, because it goes back into a history that we're still living with. But he was one mean guy, and if he didn't get his way, look out. But he could be very, I don't want to say friendly because I know better, but he could be a very affable guy. Maybe that's the best way to describe it. But he wasn't. And he was mean. He was in his last days. He was in a bedroom out at his ranch, and he would be in there pounding on the walls and bouncing off the walls, and mean, just plain mean. I don't think he ever mellowed. Well, I better take that back. I'm sure he mellowed when he was out on the ranch looking at cows, but he was a mean man. And that's why this Gordon, this fellow I'm working with, has come up with the title of his book, Evil. Because some of the things he did, now you stop and think about it when he gets John Kennedy down there and figures out, well, if I can get him to impregnate a woman, I may be able to embarrass him out of office. That's pretty evil. Now, a lot of men will say, well, you get your daughter married to the best you can, but you carry it further. And when Billy Saul Estes, a guy he was working with to get money in Texas illegally, when he is being audited by the government and Johnson finds out about it and the auditor is not going to accept a better job in Washington to drop the investigation, Johnson says he's got to go. And meaning, everyone understood, kill him. It's that kind of an attitude to protect myself. I'll kill anybody and take the chances. He did.
We all know. Several times. Well, we all know after the Kennedy assassination, that there were a lot of bizarre killings. People died. Now, I think that's pretty well stopped today. When did the hold on that stop, to where people like Jim Lovell and Jesse Ventura and Roger Stone and yourself and people can tell these stories now, William Walter, and not have bad things happen to them?
I think it became pretty clear that something had to be done, although I think I was the first one to really come out and say it and to raise quite a lot of interest. Because initially there was a whole lot of interest, and there has been ever since. People still write me loving how they love my book. But Stone based his book on mine, and a couple of others have come out also. I think I somehow broke, I don't want to call it the ceiling, but broke that barrier that the historians have put on us of not being bad to the president, that he won, history goes on, he wins. I got to tell you one other one, too. Caro reads my book, and I hear he said, well, it's not very persuasive. And I sit there and say, Caro, you've written your book, and you've convinced 10% of the country. I've got 70% on my side. I'm comfortable with what's going on. And that's just one of the developments that comes out of these exposés, so to speak. Well, not exposés. This is a fact-based disclosures, looking at all the evidence. Maybe it was, I don't know. No. I'm forgetting something very big. Oliver Stone, he really brought it home, I think. The guy that did the Men Who Killed Kennedy, really decent guy, was a big person in all that. The House Special Committee on the Assassination is another one that concluded there was a conspiracy. Robert Blakey did a fine job, especially saying you just can't trust the CIA. So it's been... Let me go where I think really, because you ask a very good question when all this started. When they started, when I say they, the Senate, started looking into Cuba and what was going on with Cuba in the 50s, and could come to the conclusion that the CIA had bought the news media. They came up with evidence that they were paying the owner of the New York Times to write articles favorable to what they wanted. You wonder how the Warren Commission can come down and be believed. Well, if the CIA is telling the newspapers and the newspapers are repeating the same thing, you're going to get it. This started during the 50s and continues to this day. The CIA does a great job. They had an impossible back in the 50s, and that was when it went to Castro, and he was going to put nuclear weapons there 90 miles from Miami, and they had to protect us. tough assignment. So you can kind of look back and say everyone was doing their job. But the way it came out was in a nuclear war. Well, thank heaven John Kennedy was there to stop it, and he did.
Early on in this interview, you said 4 days ago in New York, things were still being confirmed and brought about to you. What was your takeaway from the meeting 4 days ago in New York?
Well, that was where we were speaking with Jack, and he had asked unexpectedly to tell us what we could about his father.
Okay.
The main thing was to brief him on what was going on. I had met him back in 05, and we'd agreed to write a book, And he was telling me a couple of things I didn't know, like the DNA, and also they were going to protect him. They'd already hired a firm to protect him once it was announced he was John Kennedy's son. Instead, that was canceled. I mentioned that orders came from above. That was what we were talking about, and how what was going to happen in the books would relate to him. And he and Gordon's a big international financier. He was very big with government financing of weapons. In fact, I love the story he tells of how they were talking about financing the space station, and no one wanted to touch it. And he said, well, I'll do it. And they said, well, we couldn't figure out who the tenant was going to be. And he said, well, it was easy. It was going to be the United States. And I think their credit was good at the time. So it's this kind of thing that I've labeled Gordon an extraordinaire, a Marine extraordinaire and a financier extraordinaire. And he's the one that brought in the guys with the government that were, you know, had their hands on what was going on. We were doing that. It was as much as anything a get acquaintance meeting. Jack has, well, I say this, he ran for president. Talk about genetics. He ran for president, what was it, 4 years, 5 years ago now. I told him, Jack, you look so much like John Kennedy, we need to send you into West Virginia and let you win the state before it's even contested. He does. He just, I swear. Anyway, I try and keep him up to date with things as I hear, and things are, the only way I can describe them is things in this, what I call the totality of evidence, are everywhere. And it's a constant briefing. So that was really what the meeting was about. And he had not met Gordon before. I'd been trying to get him together, but we couldn't do that until then.
When we started this interview, Jack,
I don't know what to make of some of these things. Maybe someone you know. Maybe you're doing such a good job. Maybe you can help me. But he had not been able to go to Arlington. And I kept insisting he go. And he finally called me and said, I'm going there. And I joined him with his wife-to-be. And it was very sobering. I don't know. I've never talked to him about it. It was something I figured was so personal. If he wanted to talk, we could talk. But little things maybe mean a lot, because as we were leaving, three jets were flying over Washington, and they formed a perfect panorama over the Arlington's main entrance. Beautiful day. And he got there, and whatever it was, I guess got a little closer to his father.
Well,
things happen. It's so dramatic sometimes. And Scott, you gotta see your way through this. I don't know. I mean, I could say, just like all Americans, we look at this thing and we make our judgments and do our best.
Well, that being said, Barr, I want to bring us to one of the final questions here. One of the reasons that the book did not get a lot of attention is a lot of people said that it was based on innuendo and conversations that you were not privy to and assumptions. What do you say to those people?
Well, what you say is what goes on inside a law firm. You know, you don't need to talk through everything to know what you're doing. You say, we're going to do this, and you know why. You got to take care of different things. You don't need to assume. You don't need to cross-examine your partners to see if they're doing what's right. You have this, and I hate to say it even as a culture, but you know what's going on. You know the judges are going to be on your side. You know these people are doing these different things. And you can make a reasonable conclusion, but it's never just, you know, blind faith or anything like that. You never know what a witness is going to say. You've talked to him, you've got him ready, and you can pretty well be comfortable that he's going to say what you need him to say, and he will. And if you look at anything, we got to get to a movie on this. In fact, I've got 3 contracts on it. I'm still working on it. In fact, what I'm doing is putting out the treatments of the movies as part of the book for people to be able to help. I'm asking for that. This business of, you know, here's what we know, and, you know, ask the questions, send it to me, tell me what you know. Movies, you got to do that, but you've got to stick to the facts as best you can. You cannot invent, and that wasn't done, never done. But you can take argument, and jury argument, I mean, is what the jury's going to know anyway, only it's got to be made dramatic. And that's where these events I've been adding in here fit in. There is high drama. People don't realize it. It's not just cold-blooded murder. It's not just 6 seconds and gone. It's people.
Barb, before
especially a very great American family, the Kennedys.
Barb, before I let you go here, I want to make sure I get this in. Again, we've been chatting with Barb McClellan, the author of Blood, Money, and Power, How LBJ Killed JFK. Final two-part question here, Barb, is, we've been listening to this. How sure are you that LBJ killed JFK? And what do you say to the people who say, this is just a book to sell books? It's just about the bottom line. It's just about money.
I know from being there and from working with these same people and from what we did, that these things don't just happen. These things develop and are founded on relations that go back and things that have happened in the past, the experiences that happen between men. We know what's going on. And what to them, look at all the evidence, piece it all together. Don't expect to find in the questionable reports of the way the evidence was handled from Dealey Plaza. We're not sure the bullets went for sure. We can be pretty sure some things that Warren told us didn't happen. You talk about people making assumptions. They made some assumptions that just don't hold water. So you've got to find an explanation, and you've got to do the one thing that Warren refused to do, and that's to see who had the motive. You know, that is the first thing in any criminal investigation.
Are you 100% sure it was LBJ? Any doubt in your mind?
Not in my mind at all. I mean, I could flat say that in the Men Who Killed Kennedy. I know beyond a reasonable doubt Johnson did it.
Well,
I'm looking forward to being able to say how, and I think with what we're coming out with soon, it's going to be pretty convincing.
I look forward to that.
70% of the 70% of the vote.
Yeah, I look forward. Barb McClellan, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you. You're one of the best I've ever been with, and I really appreciate it. I'm sending you a book.
Thank you, Barb. I appreciate it. Take care. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're going to take a quick break. Come back with Larry Merchant, Bill O'Reilly. Oh, my goodness. Right after this, don't go anywhere. It's Now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, right here on WWGH Radio from 12:10 to 2 p.m. Listen to the program for guests like these. The voice of Ursula from The Little Mermaid and actress Pat Carroll.
And I think villains are the most fascinating people as an actress to play. They have more edges to them. They have more color to them. Isn't that a shame that goodness isn't more fascinating, or our world would be better?
I guess.
But there is something fascinated about tacky people, mean people. They're colorful. good people always seem to be a little bit, ugh, yucky. But bad people always have edges to them. That's why they're so wonderful to play for actors.
That?
Because you can pick all the things in life as a human being that annoy you or that you would like to do. Really rotten mean. Most people are too afraid to be rotten mean because we want people's approval. And being rotten mean isn't going to get us that. But, oh, villains for actors are the best things in the world to play.
You know, Pat, that almost describes our current political situation in this country.
Doesn't it just? I never thought of that, but you're quite right.
Join me Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio. We'll take your calls, 740-383-9944, streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com.
Hey, Scott Spears back with you here. 51 minutes past the hour, and something very big happened in the world of television. Bill O'Reilly was fired from Fox News. Fox News has paid $13 million in sexual harassment lawsuits over the years that Mr. O'Reilly has been working with Fox News. This came out recently, and yesterday Mr. O'Reilly was fired. He did release a statement, so we do want to get that in here at the top. This is from Bill O'Reilly. Over the past 20 years at Fox News, I have been extremely proud to launch and lead one of the most successful news programs in history, which has consistently informed and entertained millions of Americans and significantly contributed to building Fox into the dominant news network in television. It is tremendously disheartening that we part ways due to completely unfounded claims, but that is the unfortunate reality many of us in the public eye must live with today. I will always look back on my time at Fox with great pride in the unprecedented success we achieved and with my deepest gratitude to all of the dedicated viewers. I wish only the best for Fox News. Joining us today to discuss this is a man who knows something about the journalism business. Many years the boxing analyst for HBO Sports and has written for many newspapers and columns and periodicals all over the country. Legendary broadcaster, journalist, Larry Merchant. Larry, how are you?
Hey, Scott. You know, listening to O'Reilly's response reminded me of a famous line from the musical Chicago by John Kander. I didn't do it, and I promise never to do it again.
Well, you know, Larry, I read that statement, and he says completely unfounded claims. What was the $13 million for over all those years?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, one of the interesting things here is how the Internet has come to promote certain influences. In this case, the influence of women who want fair treatment, and at the end of the day or the night, he got fired by the sponsors, not by Fox so much. The sponsors deserted him. That is the marketplace. Why? Because they decided that he wasn't good for them anymore, because he taints their products. So it was a calculation on their part that his presence and influence in the world of journalism and politics no longer was so powerful that he can't be replaced by the next guy.
Is this a good thing? Because he was the most watched man, not just on Fox News, in all of cable news. He had the biggest audience for about 17 years. is it good for news, because a lot of people felt he had a political slant, that he is no longer there?
Well, I don't know. Is it good for news or is it good for commentary? I don't know what he did was news, although in the lineup of the Fox commentators, as I understand it, he would be considered an old-fashioned conservative, you know, rather than a pitchfork-carrying far-right winger. But if the star is of that magnitude who helped to build that network into a giant force, and both economically and politically, it's in that perspective, I think it's an important moment. But history shows that people with status, particularly men with status, often, you know, break the unspoken rules about sex at the office place. And we have a president who apparently is proud of it.
Is there any chance? Because we've seen a lot of this lately. Bill Cosby is set to stand trial in a couple months. President Trump had his own issues with this. Bill Clinton, former President Clinton, certainly had his issues with this. Is it possible that this is what O'Reilly says, that women who are not superstars just wanted to get at him? These are unfounded claims. They're not reality.
What is not reality to me is that Fox would let him go if that were the case. I don't know all of the details. I don't know if anyone knows all of the details, except hush money was paid to some women. Do you pay people millions of dollars because nothing happened? I don't know. It is a phenomenon that these men who use their power are being outed, and that women are no longer afraid to out them, because in a way it's really uncomfortable, and some of the women are not looking to make millions of dollars. And I guess we all assume that where there is smoke or brush fires, there are larger fires behind them.
You know what is interesting about this case, Larry, is that Bill O'Reilly had been there, I think, over 17 years, but for 17 years, or pretty close to it, been the number one program. This had gone on, and last night CNN did a story about a case from 2000, I think in 8, in which somebody had come out against him. Fox did not seem to have a problem. As you very aptly said, the sponsors canceled him. So do businesses with their sexual assault or sexual harassment hotlines really care as long as they're making money?
The answer would have to be no, but when they're threatened by 50 sponsors saying they don't want to be associated with this scandal, that's about money too. And Fox is not just a cable television news. Fox is part of a big conglomerate of communications, including movies and so on and so forth. Perhaps they were concerned that in putting together other kinds of programming, including movies, that maybe there are some people who would say, "Well, I don't want to work for Fox." So I think it was a calculation and pressure that, finally, it's all business,
O'Reilly did very well for himself in that business, not just on air, but with the many bestsellers he co-authored. And he symbolized a populist movement that resulted in a big political change in this country.
Can he walk over to another network and come back?
Well, you'd have to be, you don't have to be a cynic to imagine that there are discussions in other offices about whether they can hire him and how they can insulate him from this scandal, because he's proven to be a guy who attracts business and viewers and readers, and that's his path has been singular in a way.
Fox News has been the number one cable news network since 2001, right after September 11th, coincidentally. In the last 9 months, the man who put that together, Roger Ailes, and the number one show host, Bill O'Reilly, have both been fired for the same reason, sexual harassment toward women.
Well, another way to look at it is high testosterone.
They might have high T. You're exactly right. That being said, is there a culture problem there at Fox, do you think?
Perhaps. I'm not inside there, but we've seen some women leave. And now we see the two top people at the network, Ailes, who has been hailed for being a genius, and O'Reilly, so apparently that is, but maybe other, I don't know if it exists at other networks. I mean, it's a we're talking about a human thing, again, of as men with status and women who are attracted to men with status, or men with status using it in inappropriate ways in a business setting. And I think it suggests that it's starting to resonate with a powerful force of women out there who are in the workplace.
Larry, final question here. As I said, in Bill O'Reilly's statement, he says these are unfounded claims. You, a very famous, popular television figure, I believe at the height of HBO boxing, did not necessarily anything like this, but did anything ever come your way that was just possibly a plot to get money? That it just, hey, I'm going to say this happened to put the pressure on him. He doesn't want this story in the papers. I'm going to accuse Larry Merchant of this.
Well, I'll just put it this way. There was a situation at a prize fight. If I remember correctly, I think it was somewhere in Texas, maybe Houston, when several women approached me, and I just had a bad vibe. I said, "What is this going on? I've been doing this forever," and I suspected it had something to do with the promoter, who might have looked to put me in a humbled position, put it that way. But that's in the world of boxing, using sex in extreme ways is probably a part of the deal. Certainly prize fighters are approached by women, and the wealthy people around the ring are maybe open to invitations. But that was the only time I ever thought I was experiencing something weird, when both before and after a fight, suddenly women were tapping me on the shoulder or coming up to me and smiling in suggestive ways. And schmuck that I am, I just said, no, this isn't the right thing to do.
Legendary HBO boxing historian Larry Merchant. Larry, thank you so much. I wish we had more time. Hopefully we can do some more on this as time goes on, because I think it's an interesting subject.
I don't think this is the last time this will ever happen.
No, I don't. I think you might be right about that. Thank you, Larry. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Larry Merchant. Okay, we are way over on time. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Charlie Evers Show, Wednesday and Thursday, 10:10 to 12 p.m., or Friday, 1:10 to 3 p.m., right here on WWGH Radio 7.1 M. Phone.